Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical.
Hey, everybody, this is Pascal. We have another guest at Disrupt Disruption, Rodolfo Rossini. Rodolfo has spent 25 years in the world of cybersecurity, half of his career, and now the remainder of those 25 years, the other half in the space of AI, artificial intelligence. He's currently working on a stealth startup. We will not say much more about that, but he's also the lead tech coach for Conception X, where he helps and his team helps the brightest British PhDs to build incredible companies based on AI. He was a partner of Xeroth AI. He is a co-founder and CEO of Weave AI. Long history story about being in the field of AI, doing the work. It is awesome to have you here, Rodolfo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'd like to start my conversation always with a very seemingly simple question. How do you personally even think about this whole field of innovation disruption? Is it different? Are these different approaches? How do you think?
I play computer games, especially simulations rather than fantasy stuff, historical simulations. So I always take the long-term view. And when I look at disruption, I really see a trend that starts with civilization. Like, this civilization is disruption of what came before. And the rate of growth of disruption is linked to the exponential growth of technology, in the sense that first we invent fire. Okay, great. The tribe without fire gets disrupted because suddenly they can't cook their meals. And then you have the older one, the sort of like the alphabet, computation, and so forth. And then this process enters in our mind and in our collective culture with the microprocessor, right? And Intel and the internet and so forth, right? But it's happening more often. And so now we can measure it. Before, it was not obvious that this was happening. And so the way I see disruption is a process of discontinuous innovation caused by an exponential growth of technology, because technology builds on itself and compounds over time, that is happening faster and faster and faster. So that's sort of like the way I see this happening. And if we look at sort of like old companies, like one or two centuries ago, maybe within the life of an employee or life of the founder, they would not have experienced disruption. They may be like two generations down the road, right? They would have experienced disruption for that. And now we're at a point where every decade there is disruption, right? Or maybe every 3 years in some fields, and just happening faster and faster, right? So that's sort of how I see the lens through which I see disruption.
That brings me to an important question. The case, as in disruption happens more often, it happens in shorter and shorter periods of time. I'm curious, do you think as a company, as an organization, I'm not talking necessarily about the two people startup, which is, I think, operates under different auspices, but probably more the larger established corporations, can you be actually driving this? Can you be on top of this? Or is the speed now so fast that it's mostly a game of reacting?
A company is people, process, and product. So if we abstract it, whether it's, you know, two people startup or 200,000 people, it is really not. Size is a bit like in Star Wars with the Yoda saying, like, you know, do you think I can lift that because do you think I'm weak because I'm small? I don't remember the exact quote. But in the same way, you know, a larger company has more resources. It's simply how you architect the flows of information within your company. I don't think it was obvious when I started my career about, can you teach entrepreneurship or not, right? And turned out I think you can, because I come from a family of entrepreneurs. So for me, I was born into that environment, right? So it was natural for me to go there. But after 25 years, after mentoring tens of entrepreneurs, then you can teach that. And whatever entrepreneurship is, acting with incomplete information, building new products. And so at a different scale, at the macro scale, we call this innovation. It's the very same thing. I believe that you can navigate this, but you have to architect your flows of information inside your company in order to manage it. So in the same way you can teach entrepreneurship, you can teach innovation, and you can maximize that. The problem is that a lot of companies, they already been built to maximize other functions inside their company. And the idea that they start because there is a demand for a certain widget, life insurance or ships, whatever. And so your company becomes a maximizer or paperclip. Sorry, paperclip in AI is great. So you start making paperclips. And you reach a point where the market doesn't really want paperclips at that scale. They want a different type of thing. But you build the entire company that can only make paperclips. And so suddenly it's very hard from an energy perspective to actually turn a company around and say, no, actually, we were never a paperclip company. We were a company that was serving customers. Just that it happened at that moment to be needing paperclips, but their needs changed. And so we need to shift our consumption, right? And so it's very hard to have this level of abstraction. I think the business world has been done a disservice. Finally, we're looking back and see, you know, titans of the industry like Jack Welch, right? That they wrote books and that actually they were the opposite. They basically killed corporations with their management style and everything that needs to be unlearned. However, I think if I remember correctly, the average age of board members in public companies is around 58. And so there, it's very hard to really look in the mirror and say, well, actually, you know, the person, you know, I had posters of Jack Welch, a Harvard Business School. He was married with the editor of HBS Magazine. Like, he was the top of that pyramid. And I realized that it was a false religion. And instead, I should have looked at the humble, you know, Clayton Christensen with his innovator dilemma. And then he was actually the person. Maybe in 20 years, we discover that he was around too. But it requires really a paradigm shift and so much challenge within an organization that it might be very difficult for companies that have been around for a long time. Because the other, sorry for long-winded answer, but the other thing that I started my career with Fortune 500 consulting. And there was this belief that because this company had been around for 200 years, it will be automatically around for the next 200, which is absolutely not true. Right. And maybe at the time wasn't obvious. This is what I was talking about, the rate of disruption, because at the time it's like, well, we'll see this coming from a mile. It's going to take 20 years. And now it's like, no, it's going to take 2 years. And if there is an opening in the market is so efficient, they can move so many resources behind the challenger. It requires a re-architecture of the people and the process. And the output of these two will be the product.
How do you go about this in practical terms? I love the notion of the re-architecture. How would you, if you were to be called into one of those incumbent juggernauts and they say, please do this, how do you go about this?
Well, it's a very good question, but I have an answer. I don't know if it's the answer, but it's an answer that I give to everyone. And I have to give credit to the person that came first with this, who's an Apple analyst called Horace Didio, who's now is into mobility, but for many years he was the, if you wanted to know anything about Apple, he was the person, right? He was really the person the storyteller that was able to capture the brilliance of Apple. And the argument is that what he always asked, right, why nobody copies Apple? And because what he was arguing, and what I believe to be an absolute truth of in this, is that a lot of people look at Apple and the same people look at the finger and not the bone, that they copy the product, they copy the iPhone, they copy the app, they copy the leather, Corinthian leather UI or to whatever. I think we haven't had that for 10 years, right? But you know what I'm talking about. You copy the output. And his question was deeper, like why nobody copies Apple itself, the company? Because when you look at Apple, the product of Apple is to some extent the process. Is Apple itself is internally how a product is generated, like this process of identifying a need, building a product around it and iterating and shipping. Right? In some cases, it can take a decade, right? More likely five to 10 years. And the output of this is the iPhone. And so when you see, for example, Apple talking about their product, and again, everyone copies the Apple the demo day or whatever it's called. They, you know, down to the turtleneck. There are some Chinese company where the guy shows up with sneakers and turtleneck. It's like, no, you're copying you're copying the wrong thing. You're copying the output, but it's your inputs are different. And you do, they when you listen to their, and I really recommend your listen to go back and listen to the to old announcements, both the current CEO and previous CEO, and then see that they never really talk about why they do things. Why do they want to give you an Apple Watch? Why do they think that, like, how these things fit in your life? Because that betrays the process that they use to actually discover these things. Once you start noticing, it becomes the elephant in the room, because they never talk about that. They always talk about, you can do these things, like you can do photos, you can do, you know, 8 megapixels, right? And people using the product, but it's sort of like humane driven approach to basically analyzing a need and trying to augment this need by using software, which I think it's not an Apple, not a tech exclusivity. I think every company is now a software company, or more, it's in the same way that every company is an electricity company. It's like, you use electricity, great, you're a startup, and you use software, great, you did the same thing. But you would not run a company and say, we don't use electricity in this company, we don't think electricity is part of our core business. In this way, I would say, would be started to look at the customers from their core needs, from the very, very basic. Again, there's another small piece of information that I don't know how many people are aware of this. At Apple Design, you're given a book called The Tree of Knowledge, which I acquired for by pure chance one day, and I discovered, I think because now Apple buys it, it's I think $7,200. You can't find new copies. It's ridiculous how expensive it is. And it's written by these two people in South America that starts from the first principle, meaning that they start looking at what are the laws of the universe and how the universe is architected. And basically what their argument is that everything flows from there. Everything is deterministic. And so once you understand that everything is a transformative function with an input and an output, and the input is the output of the previous function tracing back to the black hole, and they really take you through the entire thing. It's like, and basically say, well, look, you know, businesses are built because the Big Bang was, you know, 13.8 billion years ago, or I might get it wrong. And this is how we have business today. And sort of like you have to take this. And so everything is a very deterministic, complex system, meaning that yes, it's deterministic, but you can't really predict the output without, and every time you try to model it, you mess things and become chaotic, right? But it's not chaotic. And so, like, I would practically start looking at how people live and how people are going to live and how people live around a certain product and their needs. But I would look at what is humanity is going to interact with the product, and how is culture going to shape around. And by what I mean by culture, I don't mean movies. I mean the way we communicate, me and you, like our languages, culture, and everything. It's like, I know this sounds really annoyingly, you know, this would sound like something like a medium post but it's true. Like, you really have to go to this, like, first principles and build everything from there. So I would really try to figure out the abstraction at the super abstract level, and then start walking down.
It's absolutely amazing, and it fits nicely into narrative we heard on this podcast a couple times, where they tend to come back to this point, saying that you have to start at first principles. You have to start at the points of, what do I know to be true, and then start building up from there, as well as you have to start with the customer and the customer need. I love the way you framed this. I'm also very curious to see if I can snag one of those books, probably not quite for the price you named, but we'll see if we find one. Rodolphe, I'm curious, if you were to take the inverse, and from your observation, what is it you find companies are typically stumbling over? Outside of course, the exact inverse of what you just talked about, which is they start artificially copying the iWatch or the Apple Watch, and not really asking themselves, what is it we actually want to build? What is it what the consumer wants? But I'm curious, what other things do you find companies typically get wrong?
I think the biggest crime is that the Innovator's Dilemma, the book from Clayton Christensen, is not considered standard reading for every single director, right? And not just reading, like really deeply understanding his body of work. And they, probably these people studied Durker at university, and Durker is exceptional. It's great, and it's really wide-ranging, and it's a favorite of mine, right? But Clayton Christensen really captured this problem of discontinuous innovation and disruption. And not only with a fancy book about, but actually with 40 years of data, even predating the internet and everything. And really, you see these car crashes, whether it's national level, the European level, or between continents, where you probably know how this movie is going to play out. But because there is so much money at stake and so many people are paid not to understand that, they refuse to understand that this is going to play out. But I have to say, it's probably the lack of adoption. And this is in some corners of the US, right? This was forced because other corners adopted it. And so they started to compete with each other. And there were those that did not start, those that did not became aggressive with M&A and investments and everything simply fell behind. But this sort of innovation takes time to propagate. And now we're seeing all the American investments coming into Europe, the Chinese investment coming in Europe. And now sort of we are, I'm saying that 2020, we are on a level playing field. So yes, the short answer is read more Clayton Christensen.
I love it. Rodolfo, I want to talk a little bit about AI. And I'm curious about AI, not from the perspective of AI and the application of AI in a broad range of industries and sectors and use cases is disrupting. I'm curious to hear your perspective of the role of AI in the process of disruption or innovation. As in, do you think we can leverage and how do we leverage artificial intelligence inside of our organizations as a tool to help us with that topic of disruption?
Again, I'm going to take the long route, the scenic route to get there. So I believe AI is probably, the investing in AI is one of the most important things that we can do, both as a personal company and society. And this narrative is fractal. If we look at every golden age of every empire, right, in the history of humanity, they've always been built on somebody else's labor and forced labor. Every golden age was built on slavery in our society. And we are now at the point where within our lifetime, we are going to be able to build a golden age that is not built on slavery. I mean, it will be built on machine slavery, but I'm not sure I would characterize an AI yet as a slave. That point, that day will come. And first, it's going to be an adoption about intellectual, so like software AI, and then the robotics will come. We thought it was going to be the opposite, but then we realized actually automating white collar job is way easier than doing robots, and robots are super complicated. And so we will experience, again, within a very short time frame, way, way shorter than the industrial revolution, the same disruption that artisans faced with the invention of all the tools and the machinery of the Industrial Revolution. It's going to be exactly the same thing. It's not going to be as obvious because it will happen behind the scenes, but we know this is happening. And we know this is happening way, way faster. So the faster it happens, the less disruptive is going to be in the long term. And I believe that we were in a world where first you had one company selling paperclip per city. Now we ended up in one company selling paperclips per country. And now we will end up in a company selling paperclips per continent. And the collapse point is that we will end up with a company making paperclips in the entire world. Already it's happening, right? You know, the mobile phones with two manufacturers. Then there is a value chain around it. And so the question is, if you're an insurance company or you make boats or anything, are you preparing for being that company? If not, then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the only way to scale to that is to automate as much as possible. So this is why I think AI adoption of AI, whether it's the tool to help you write or the tool to edit podcasts or the tool to do video conference or one-to-one, like everything. Now you have all these tools and suddenly they will start to coalesce together into one and sort of like Siri or idealized HAL 9000, as opposed to having all these different tools. But the AI itself will be a victim of this Darwinian process where the best will survive, and through multiple cycle, only one or two entities will survive, which again fits into the Clayton Christensen book, by the way.
A little detour, but do you think that will lead into a world which is then dominated by a few paperclip manufacturers?
Yes, for certain things. There are going to be energy for razor production and transport. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be, you're going to have a budget for this energy. It's going to be a trade-off. So there might always going to be some local food production, for example. There's going to be always local producer and might not be advantageous to have one milk producer for the entire world. But for things that require manufacturing and they required R&D and constant innovation, governments will fight tooth and nail. But already we have one provider of social networking that has 2.5 billion customers. Like, go back 20 years or 40 years and say, oh, we're going to have one company that this and they have 2 billion customers. Right? It really... I mean, go back 10 years and tell people that the Facebook.net is going to be worth $1 trillion. Yeah. And they're going to ask you, oh my God, there's going to be a war and hyperinflation, which is also true, but this different. But yeah, we will end up, I believe, we will be forced partially in this by geopolitics, because that's what's happening in China. In China, you do have the sort of like centralized view that there is one provider of search engine, one provider of financial information, everything. The government kind of control, directly controls one, so there is no deeper competition. And so the world is slowly discovering that there is 1.4 billion Chinese, and the US and Europe together, and it's 800 million or so. And so we will end up with larger and larger entities to try to not be dominated, China and possibly India down the road. So I believe that we will end up with a power balance on all these things, at least for things that require scale, as I said, mm-hmm. services and products and manufacturing and whatnot.
In that scenario, how do you overcome the seemingly inevitable tendency for these juggernautical systems to eventually slow down in their ability to innovate? We had this grand experiment failed with the Soviet Union and communism, which had a similar idea, the idea of centralized manufacturing. In East Germany, you could buy exactly one car, the Trabant, and the lack of market forces essentially ultimately stalled out the market.
Because I was saying before, is that if there is an opening and if there is a regulatory market that favors the challenger versus incumbent, mm-hmm. then I don't really see this. I know it's a very overused and abused thing, but the market will take care of itself. But mm-hmm. if there is proper regulation. And again, here, Europe scores very badly because historically, as a result of the devastation of World War II, we have a lot of societal and welfare rules that prevents challenges to the status quo. And you know, the crazy thing is, because the Nazis had this thing called Mephobils in 2021, I still, in Germany, you still can't do early stage funding on startup, which is like, I still find it mind-blowing. I mean, you can do it, it's just super expensive, super laborious. And so you end up doing it in the UK or in Estonia. I don't know.
It's fascinating. Let me ask you a last question, a closing question. I always like to ask this question. I'm curious, how bullish or bearish are you about the ability, the chances for incumbent organizations to actually manage this change? Are they ultimately, do we think they're doomed? Can they do it?
My meta view is positive. So I think there is I'll use the term inoculation because it's 2021, right? So all about viruses and vaccines. And I think the people that they grew up and they were born in a hyper-connected world, that as young children had access to Facebook. And so they were already born into this global village. And they will have no problem understanding this world, right? This new world. And people that were not online at the time, I think they will struggle to see and still struggle to adapt, right? And this is what I was saying, that people that today sit on boards, they were too late. And it's like Douglas Adams says, everything that was there before I was born, it's boring. Everything that was invented before I was 30, oh, it's great. And everything after 30 is like, oh my God, we need to ban this. It's horrible. And he said it comically, but I believe it's entirely true. And so I think that I have an incredible, I think our generation, Gen X, still majority of them were not online when they should have. And so I think with the millennial and Gen Z, I'm super bullish. Super.
Rodolfo, on those positive words, also I love the fact that you're calling out our younger generations, because I'm also extremely bullish about what a particular Gen Z is going to do to this world and with this world. Rodolfo, thank you so much. This was an absolutely incredible conversation. I love the wide-ranging array of answers we got into. I love the fact that we started on first principles. We learned a little bit about history here and see how all these things connect. So really, really enjoyed this conversation. For you, all the very best for your startup. I know that you're working on something really tremendously amazing. Can't wait to hear once it becomes non-stealthy. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. Also know that this is part of an effort of us writing a book about disruption. So keep your eyes and ears peeled towards that. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and just like this. There's some weird algorithm thing, which, you know, if you like it, they will like us. So do me a favor, do that. And if you've got any questions, any comments, anyone I should talk to, drop us an email. Easiest email address for me to reach it is p@finet.com. With that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.